3CR would like to acknowledge the Kulin Nation, true owners, caretakers, and custodians of the land from which we broadcast. 3CR pays respect to elders past and present of the Kulin Nation. We recognise their unceded sovereignty.
This is 3CR Breakfast. Oh, yeah. Alternative news, analysis, and current affairs. Monday to Friday, 7 a.m. to 8:30 a.m.
Only double.
Grab your pants.
Good morning, listeners. You are tuned into Thursday Morning Breakfast on 3CR 8:55 a.m. It is Thursday, the 6th of November. Good morning, Inez.
Good morning.
How's it going?
It's good. Just coming off the big long weekend that we had. And so many incredible, like, events, but really I just took it really slow. And then I had a big dance on one of the nights.
That's beautiful.
It was a really beautiful, like, random evening. And I got to listen to some very, like, spooky techno.
Oh, very nice.
How was your weekend?
Look, I can't say that it was as fun as that. But honestly, the first thing that comes to mind when I'm thinking about how I'm doing is this morning when I was riding in, I passed for the first time in a very long time a car that had a sticker that says F cyclists on it.
What?
And it immediately made me want to fight. I was like, I am going to. And then I was like, you know what? Just morally, cyclists are more powerful than drivers. I'm out here with my whole body on the line. You're inside a metal cage. Oh, what are you afraid of? What are you afraid of out here?
Yeah, you coward.
Exactly. That's right. I invite all drivers to fight me.
Absolutely. Christmas present for you, box of gloves.
Yes. I'm not dropping my address, though, so please don't find me.
Speaking of fighting. We are going to hear a standby from a conversation that Uncle Robbie Thorpe and Senator Lydia Thorpe had on Friday's Black and Deadly program about Treaty, which was recently going through Parliament. And yeah, you can catch Black and Deadly every Friday at 11 a.m. And then we will have an in-studio interview with Sade, a GP trainee at a community health clinic, who are joining us to discuss the ongoing organising for Save CoHealth. Now, there's a rally this Saturday on the 8th of November at Sarah Whitty's office for Labor, and the rally is calling on federal and state emergency funding to save the clinics. We've been doing ongoing reporting, but this is just like the next step in mobilising, particularly from the town hall last week.
Yeah, I mean, it's going to be a busy weekend because there's also been a solidarity rally for Sudan called. So stay tuned. We'll be talking about that later in the show. After that, we are going to hear some reflections from Dr. Ezzedine Shahab, who is a Palestinian physician in northern Gaza. And Dr. Shahab has collaborated with Readers and Writers Against the Genocide to publish Diary of a Young Doctor, which is a remarkable collection of diary entries that he's kept to document his eyewitness accounts of the genocide. And he remains in northern Gaza and is currently in the process of reestablishing a community clinic that he set up but was unfortunately forced to close in July of this year due to ongoing Israeli aggression. And after that, I'm going to play a couple of messages, some important community announcements. One is a message from Benin Manirakiza, who's the mom of Amable Manirakiza. And Amable's coronial inquest directions hearing is next Monday, the 10th of November at the Coroner's Court of Victoria. And Benin is asking community to show up in solidarity with Amable's family and loved ones from 9:30 a.m. on Monday to sit with them in court during this incredibly difficult process. And after that, we're also going to hear a short message from Mona Zahed, who is a Gazan chef and mother whose recipe book, Tabka, Recipes from Under the Rubble, is available for purchase with proceeds supporting Mona and her family and now the establishment of a school.
Yeah, these are really incredible messages that I'm sure will move all of us, and can't wait to listen to them as well. And last week, I caught up with a touch sensitive, aka Michael D. Francesco, who is one of Australia's most beloved electronic artists, bassists, and producers, known for his Italo disco flair, piano house grooves, and undeniable presence on the dance floor. Since breaking through with the cult classic Pizza Guy, he's become a staple of the Australian music scene. From releasing his acclaimed debut album Visions in 2017, sold out national tours, countless collaborations, he's an artist's artist and brings nothing but groove and euphoria to the dance floor. And we'll talk about the long-awaited second album, In Paradise, which has been 8 years in the... in the making, being performed with a stacked live band this Saturday at the Nightcat in Fitzroy, and we'll be playing the title track of his album too.
Amazing. And finally, we will be joined by filmmaker, photographer and organizer Bakri Mahmoud, who's going to speak with us about the ongoing mutual aid efforts that he's been helping to coordinate for Sudan. And Bakri is also going to discuss the importance of disrupting narratives of civil war being used to brand the catastrophic conflict between the RSF and SAF, the responsibilities and failures of so-called Australia in taking action on the crisis, and the importance of continued efforts to support Sudanese liberation. And there is a rally for Sudan Remembering Our Martyrs, which is being held on Sunday, the 9th of November, outside the State Library of Victoria from 12 p.m., calling for justice for the El Fashir massacres. So, stay tuned, and we'll get back to you shortly with the news headlines for today.
It's the government's job to protect Australia's forests and oceans, but too often, governments put the interests of big corporations ahead of protecting your health, your climate, and your children's future. The Albanese government is about to change Australia's nature law. While this might seem like telling them how to suck eggs, we expect laws that actually protect nature by closing deforestation loopholes and protecting threatened species. It's literally their job. Head to wilderness.org.au/suck eggs to learn more. The Wilderness Society is a 3CR supporter.
These are the news headlines for Thursday, the 6th of November. More than 70,000 civilians have fled North Darfur following the Rapid Support Forces' capture of El Fashir, and it's pushed east downward toward El Obeid in North Kordofan. The United Nations has warned of escalating atrocities and famine across Darfur and Kordofan, where entire communities have been emptied amid reports of execution, sexual violence and starvation. The ICC has opened an investigation into the Rapid Support Forces commanders for war crimes and crimes against humanity committed during the group's recent assault on El Fashir. Hundreds of Sudanese refugees protested outside the United Nations office in Jakarta this week, calling for urgent international action to stop the genocide in Sudan and to resettle hundreds of Sudanese refugees stranded in Indonesia for more than a decade. Advocates say successive Australian governments have a long-standing, informal ban on resettling Sudanese refugees, an approach that ignores the current crisis.
Also in headlines, in a long-overdue response to Israel's genocide in Gaza, the Albanese government has quietly introduced minimal new restrictions stopping defence manufacturers in so-called Australia directly exporting to Israel. The reported move follows relentless pressure from Palestinians and advocates demanding the government meet its international obligations to play no part, direct or indirect, in Israel's genocide and illegal occupation. The Australia-Palestine Advocacy Network are calling for the ban to be permanent and to end all defense ties with Israeli firms, including involvement in the F-35 fighter jet program funneled through the United States.
Despite these reported restrictions, 12 protesters have been charged outside the state-sponsored Indo-Pacific Defence Expo in Gadigal Country, Sydney, this week, where demonstrators targeted the presence of Israeli weapons manufacturers. The event was attended by Israeli arms firms Elbit Systems and Rafael, and has drawn criticism from the human rights experts who say the Australian government is breaching its obligations to prevent genocide by endorsing the company's participation. Organisers from the Palestinian Action Group said police initiated the confrontation and used pepper spray on the crowd.
Meanwhile, in Gaza, journalists are reporting that the Israeli army has launched raids and intensive artillery shelling while carrying out demolitions in southern Gaza. And as winter sets in, humanitarian agencies say that more than 260,000 displaced Palestinian families remain without proper shelter after Israel rejected multiple aid requests to deliver nearly 4,000 pallets of tents, blankets, and other essential items.
Also in news this week, New analysis shows Centrelink has issued more than 2.6 million payment suspension notices to job seekers and people on disability support pensions over the course of just 12 months, the equivalent of more than 5 per minute. Advocates say the mass suspensions disproportionately affect First Nations people and people with disabilities, calling for the regime to be halted until it is proven to comply with the law. This comes after the Anti-Poverty Centre calls on the government to withdraw a proposed law that would allow police and ministers to cancel Centrelink payments for people accused, but not convicted, of serious offences, warning it undermines due process.
And finally in headlines, the Herald Sun has been called out for misreporting state crime data after the newspaper falsely claimed that 91.1% of young people failed to complete community correction orders, when the opposite is true. The annual crime statistics released by the State Department of Justice in fact reported that more than 98% of young people successfully completed their diversionary orders, and that rehabilitation programs are proving highly effective in reducing reoffending. Stay tuned for more accurate and political news coverage on 3CR 855 AM. These have been your news headlines for Thursday, the 6th of November.
The annual Melbourne Pacifica Festival is on again, 10 AM to 7 PM Saturday, December the 6th, at the playground end of Banjo Paterson Park in Lynbrook. Immerse yourself in the richness of Pacific Island culture with traditional dance, dynamic drumming, soulful harmonies, bands, guest artists, children's activities including rugby clinics, Pacifica arts and crafts, and yummy food. Lots of fun and activities for the whole family. Saturday, December the 6th in Lynbrook. Visit melbournepacificafestival.org. Melbourne Pacifica Festival is a 3CR supporter.
Welcome back to 3CR Thursday Breakfast. You've just heard the headlines, and now we're going to listen to a discussion about treaty between Uncle Robbie Thorpe and Senator Lydia Thorpe from last Friday's Black and Deadly program. You can listen to Black and Deadly every Friday, but right now, let's take a listen.
I was going to say the treaty bill went through the upper house, and it's progress.
I'm going to put inverted commas on that one.
More than what we have, and we know that there's good people involved in the process. But I just want to say, Uncle Rob, you know, when the Labor government wanted to hear from our people about constitutional recognition and the voice, you stood up at that meeting of over 100 people and said, no, we don't want that. We want a treaty. And from that moment, the process that we've seen over the last, whatever it's been, 6-8 years, has been as a result of you standing up and calling for treaty. So it might not be what you stood up for, what we see going through the upper house and what is now in legislation. But it is, you know, it is progress, and Aboriginal people will have more influence through this legislation to make the government more accountable to our people than they were before.
Yeah, hopefully that's the case. I'm a bit concerned that it's, it's not a, it hasn't got this international legal scrutiny and things. And like this thing called the Vienna Law of Treaties, like, it's been 250 years since, you know, the colonisers were told to get consent to negotiate a basis of occupation in this country. That's basically what talking about a treaty. It's 250 years in waiting. You know, and I really believe we owe it to our ancestors, this land, and our children's children's children. And we want to get these things right. And what concerns me is, what really irked me about it, the whole thing was, it was a treaty for Victoria. Who the hell is Victoria? Why are we enshrining her name in this document when it should be enshrining our names? That really offended me. It just told me they didn't really understand, you know, what a real treaty meant. But, like you said, it may be a progress. I'm glad we're talking about things like treaties. Hopefully a lot of people have been educated about what a treaty is. But it's not over yet, you know. And, you know, this is... They kept telling us, oh, don't worry, we're not going to cede our sovereignty in this process. Oh, yeah, well, we'll keep looking at that, see if that's the case. But what it seems to me, we're acknowledging the state in the process here. It should be the other way around, and that's what really worries me. I could never trust the state government in this country. Mm. Got no reason to. Mm. And, you know, where's this customary law stand in this whole process? It should be up front and centre from the beginning. Mm. What are the... Is there rights to be talking about here? Is there land back?
No.
Did they end the war? No. Treaties to me is about ending wars. No talk of that. So, anyway.
I agree with you. I absolutely wholeheartedly agree. Obviously, you've been my mentor in my life. And when we walked out of the meeting at Yalara, which they said it was Uluru, but it was actually Yalara, I stood with many staunch sovereign elders and activists and read out a statement that we put together, calling on a internationally scrutinised treaty in line with the Geneva Convention. And it was about acknowledging that we are sovereign people of these lands. No, this treaty is not that. It is a administrative treaty, as I see it, and I don't know what benefits it's going to bring.
Seems to be bolstering the service for services regime in our, which we've always had. It's like bolstering that, you know. We really need to talk about customary law over this land. It's in the interest of all people. We've got a superior law here, as far as I'm concerned. It took care of this country for a long time. You know, at least our people could say that we had clean air, water and food and land that we lived on. Mm. That's not the case today. But you know, our laws are important and superior than the colonisers' law. Mm. So it's got to be acknowledged in a real way. Hopefully this is a step in the right direction. And the mobs who are negotiating their treaties at the grassroots level, the tribal level, well, they can bring all these issues up. But I hope we're not set up in a situation where we're trapped in a process. And I'm not too sure whether the rest of the country can, they can get a lot out of what not to do, right? Which way not to go on things like this. So hopefully it's in some use. Poor old Victoria has taken another knock. Our mobs in this place called Victoria. Victoria is the premier state. Mm. This is where all the law emanates out of in this country. This is the standard. And look at the treatment of Aboriginal people. It's got the worst record of human rights, environment, species depletion, environment. It's the most disgusting of them all. And we're talking a treaty, and we're talking about better services. Where's the rights? Where's the land back? When's the end of the war? When's the end of the hostilities? We're talking about all these issues that we've got today. And still got deaths in custody, stealing our kids, raping the land. When's that all going to end? That's not part of the treaty process, it seems.
Apparently not yet. I'm trying to be a politician here. and as a Gunai Gunitjmara and Djaparung woman, when it comes time for our tribal voice to be able to participate, I certainly want land back. I certainly want the end to the destruction of land and water and our people, the incarceration rates, as you say, the child removals, Latrobe Valley on Gunai Country, you know, we have the highest removal rates of children. We have a coal-fired power station that is killing people, literally killing people. So if we can't say we want that shut down for the good of our land, our water, our people, and for the good of all people,
yes, that's right.
then I would question then what is the point of a treaty?
Yeah. Well, it'll be interesting how it flows from here. I'm not holding my breath about being liberated and acknowledged and this war, this undeclared war being acknowledged and ended. I think there's still issues. Those fundamental issues like that need to be addressed properly.
Mm.
And, who do we do a treaty with? Who is the other side, and we're sovereigns on this land? Who are we doing a treaty with? Colonial states or the crown?
Well, the king certainly wasn't interested when I put it to him. He is responsible. Absolutely.
Because if you look at every bit of law that's ever made in this country, it's got a thing called royal assent. Well, who are the royals? Andrew? Well, what's his name? Andrew? No, not Andrew. Charles.
Charlie.
That's his brother, Andrew. Pretty disgraceful. As far as I'm concerned, they're a crime family. They're responsible for what's happened to Aboriginal people, and they still are, and they benefit from our people, from this land and the destruction of our people. So I want to make them answer.
And the proceeds of crime.
That's right. They're living on the proceeds of crime. Mm. And all their palaces and things like that. I was watching them today on television today.
Gross.
It's all gross, you know. This is what it's all amounted to, you know. We can do a lot better. And all the people living on our land, you know, it's not a convict penal colony no more. You're not subject to these rat bags. Stand up.
Mm.
And our people too, it's more than just handouts.
Mm.
We've got law, proper law we need to acknowledge and live by ourselves, you know.
Mm. I want to, just acknowledge that there are, you know, as I said, good people that have been part of the Treaty Assembly. And they're doing it from the goodness of their hearts and do want to do the right thing. So I just want to acknowledge all of those members of the Treaty Assembly and particularly the Uruk Commission and the process of truth-telling and, that needing to happen at the federal level. They've got to stop lying to people in this country. They need to start telling the truth. And the Uruk Commission did a really good job of that. This isn't a Labor treaty. And for all those Labor people patting themselves on their back and going wild on their social media, this is long overdue. And if you think it's that good, then tell your mates at the federal level, particularly the Prime Minister, the so-called Prime Minister of this country, that he needs a treaty and he needs to give land back and he needs to stop the war on our people through all of the genocidal acts that continue today.
And giving away our stolen land to people like Trump and others around the world, you know. They haven't got a treaty, Oz. How can you be trading on land here and things like that? So they're obliged to. And, maybe the federal, it should have been a federal thing anyway, because our response at those dialogue meetings in regards to the voice was a federal thing. Where did the state come from and end up being involved in a localised treaty business? That's what disturbed me as well. Well, no one asked them. It was in regards to the federal legislation and the fact that we're not in your constitution. We're not subject to your law. You haven't got the treaty. You haven't got consent. Well, you're trading on our land. You know, come on, Oz. We can get this right. Hopefully it's been a good lesson, actually, this treaty. And that's one of the probably the good things that has happened for our young people is they've learnt all about these issues, about treaty business.
Mm.
Maybe not as much as they should know, but at least it's a step in the right direction on that front. Mm. And who knows what can happen when a federal legislation... Who overrides? Does the federal legislation override the state? Apparently it does.
Well, it does in certain areas,
yeah,
but not all.
It's a game now, yeah. Mm. Yeah, so anyway, we'll see what happens in the near future, I reckon. But, you know, take heed, the rest of these states, just be careful about this process. They call on a treaty. It's not the international standard treaty.
And it was interesting, Noongar mob came out and said, hey, you mob in so-called Victoria, that's not the first treaty. We did a treaty. And I thought that was interesting that, you know, that was called a treaty, the Noongar settlement.
How long ago? Oh, was it 1837?
No. This was like in the last decade.
Okay.
Yeah.
And I haven't heard of that one.
Yeah, massive settlement, Noongar settlement.
Oh, over Perth area, yeah. In the main, yeah. Well, that all needs to be looked at. You know, there's standards we can go by. And we should have been looking at other international treaties, like the Two-Row Wampum Treaty of Canada, which is a Commonwealth country. That's an amazing treaty. It's nearly 500 years old. Incredible treaty. They're the standards we should have been used, not a state colonial-based thing. You know, you can see what's going on there.
Well, I think that they did travel. I know that they went to Aotearoa. I think they went to Turtle Island. Mm. But, you know, it depends who you talk to.
Yeah, and they can pick and choose what they want to take from those things as well, you know. You know, we're entitled to a lot in this country, what's happened to our people, you know, we want that resolved. This is for the ancestors, for the land and for the children's children. We don't want to be making mistakes there. Mm. We waited long enough.
You're listening to Thursday Morning Breakfast on 3CR 855 AM, and it is 7:27 in the morning. And that was a really important conversation about treaty between Uncle Robbie Thorpe and Senator Lydia Thorpe from last Friday's episode of Black and Deadly on 3CR. You can listen to the full conversation by heading to 3cr.org.au/blackanddeadly. And remember to tune in to Black and Deadly every Friday at 11 a.m. on 3CR 855 a.m.
Help us stay radical. Become a regular donor to 3CR. A regular donor is someone who loves 3CR so much that they set up an automatic donation to 3CR on the same day every month. 3CR is determined to stay independent. This means we don't rely on corporate sponsorship or government funding. We serve our community, not corporate interests. But this also means we do rely on people like you to keep the station running. From paying the bills to maintaining our studios to training the next generation of community broadcasters, 3CR relies on community donations to survive. By becoming a regular donor, you can help us stay resilient and radical. Will you help 3CR by becoming a regular donor today? Together, we can keep independent voices on air. Go to 3cr.org.au.
Now, we have an important message for you from the family of Imabale Manirakiza, a young man whose life was tragically lost in August of 2021, or between July and August of 2021, I should say, after he went missing in Werribee. There was an extended community search, and unfortunately, his body was found by community members at that time. And finally, a coronial inquest has been, will commence shortly into his passing. There's a directions hearing that is scheduled for Monday, the 10th of November. And here is a message from Imabale's mum, Benin, speaking about that hearing.
Hey, this is Benin Manirakiza. I am a mother to Imabale Manirakiza. I just want to let you know that the direction hearing is on Monday, the 10th of November, at 10 a.m. at the coroner court. I and my family and loved ones really appreciate who can join us outside beforehand and sit with us during the court time. It is important to us all during this difficult time, and we really appreciate you all very much. Thank you. I hope to see you there to support us, to hold us a hand, because this time is not easy for us. We love you all. Thank you very much.
Thank you very much to Benin for that heartfelt message, and really encourage people to get down to the Coroner's Court of Victoria on Monday, the 10th of November. That is next Monday at 9:30 a.m. in advance of the directions hearing, which begins at 10 a.m. That is 65 Cavanagh Street in Southbank. A directions hearing is held before a coronial inquest, and it's where the coroner decides things like what the inquest is going to look at, who the witnesses will be, and the dates that the inquest will be held. And it's just so important to support families through this incredibly difficult process. And we will also have links in our show notes to how to support Amabile's family during the coronial inquest by donating to a fundraiser that will support the family to attend the inquest and the directions hearing. So we will have much more information in our show notes. And to follow updates about Amabile's coronial inquest, you can head to @justiceforEIMABLE, @justiceforAmabile on Instagram. And we will be back to you shortly.
3CR is about community, and we welcome your participation at the station.
3CR is open to a wide diversity of volunteers and is a great way to connect with Melbourne's activist community.
Have you ever thought about volunteering, doing a reception shift, getting a program on air,
training in radio skills, or contributing to one of the station's committees?
There are many ways to be involved at 3CR.
To find out more, go to 3cr.org.au and get in touch.
You're listening to Thursday Breakfast on 3CR 855 AM, and I have another important message to share with you. This time, it's from a previous guest on the show, Mona Zahed, a Palestinian chef and mother who sent us a message to play about her book, Tabqa, Recipes from Under the Rubble, a remarkable illustrated recipe book of Palestinian Gazan recipes that Mona developed during her experience of the genocide. Now, Mona is still in Gaza, and she's using the proceeds that have been raised through purchases of Tabqa to support herself and her family, but now to support the establishment of a school. And this is her latest initiative to contribute to her community, and she really does remarkable work. So let's hear that message from Mona now.
Hello, friends. I'm speaking to you after surviving the war that lasted for 2 years. My family and I suffered a lot, and we lost many friends and possessions. But at the same time, I found other things like good friends around the world, and I learned many things to help me stay strong and save my family. Among the miracles that happened to me was my Tabqa book, which has become my main source of income during these difficult times. So thanks to your donation and your support in purchasing the book, I'm now beginning a new chapter in my life, starting a school to teach children after the destruction of schools in my country. Although my school begins with a displacement tent, I hope it's just the beginning of saving Gaza's children from ignorance. And one day the tent will become a real school. So thanks to every support you can do. Thank you from the bottom of our hearts for everything you have always done for us. Your love means the world to me. Thank you. Mona Zahed.
And that was a beautiful message from Palestinian chef and mum Mona Zahed, whose book Tabkha is going to be raising proceeds not just to support herself and her family in Gaza, but also to begin the Basmat Amal School. It's an education initiative that Mona, as she just explained, is starting in a displacement tent, but is really hoping to continue to educate children in her community and, yeah, just do this incredible community service work. So please support Mona's initiatives. You can follow her on Instagram at @MONA86_Zahed, Z-A-H-E-D. And you can also purchase the book by going to Slingshot Books, but we will have more information in our show notes. Now, Inez.
Yes, now we are joined in the studio by Sade, who is a doctor at a community health clinic, who's also worked in public hospitals, who joins us to discuss organising for the Save CoHealth rally this Saturday, 8th of November, at Sarah Whitty's office. The rally is calling on the federal and state emergency funding to save clinics that service over 12,000 people. We've covered it over the last few weeks, but this is the next kind of mass mobilisation following the town hall in Fitzroy. But thank you so much for joining us here today, Shannon.
Thanks so much for having me.
Could you tell us a little bit about the work that you do and kind of the impact that you're feeling from the closure of CoHealth?
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, I'm pretty lucky to work in a community health centre. There aren't many that still exist. Most of sort of primary care has been privatised and increasingly corporatised over the last 2 decades, which has sort of materially led to a decrease in bulk billing and a real sort of struggle in maintaining universal healthcare with people not able to afford, the sort of very fundamental prevention and screening, the upstream health interventions that keep people well. Certainly after we heard these announcements a fortnight ago, our patients have been reeling. The concerns are sort of twofold. One, sort of intense compassion for the people who are losing their GPs, and lots of people from CoHealth who are sort of scrambling and trying to find another bulk billing clinic in the area. Unfortunately, only 2 days after the announcement was made, the clinic had to close its books because already we're sort of having patients wait 2 or 3 weeks for a doctor. And so certainly servicing hundreds, let alone thousands more, is beyond the scope. But also our really, really vulnerable patients who rely on us to sort of coordinate their healthcare, coordinate with their specialists, who really, sort of see the community health center as a lifeline, are concerned that ours will follow, because it's certainly a very, very similar model and under the same financial pressures. There's a real feeling in the community of, crisis and catastrophe following these announcements.
Yeah, absolutely. And I think, I was at the town hall last week and there's so much devastation and anger and frustration in the room of how you could let this happen. And I know that's, as we've spoken about, there's GP closures at Collingwood, Fitzroy, Kensington, and then the closure of Collingwood entirely. And yeah, we need a bailout. But I'm also curious, because you've worked in public hospitals as well as community health centres. Because this is probably what is going to happen. What happens when people have no sense of community healthcare, preventative healthcare, and then their only doctor is the emergency room? Yeah. What happens when you have that as your point of contact?
It's a disaster. So it's in sort of short terms, because certainly in sort of multiple ways. One, people delay care because they know that they're going to be sitting in a waiting room for 12 hours, particularly if they're going to for non-urgent appointments. Two, the GP that does so much that the emergency department just can't do. Things like just routine scripts, monitoring. The emergency department is not going to do that. Sort of mental health care plans and chronic disease care plans, things that give you access to sort of subsidized allied health, to psychology, the emergency department is not going to do that. And certainly in terms of sort of continuity of care, preventative care, screening, sort of managing sort of complex patients with multiple clinicians and services involved, the emergency department can't do that when meeting you for the first time. The other sort of point to be made is that it's so much more expensive. So the subsidy see for a GP appointment is about, you know, $42 for a standard one. A non-urgent emergency presentation, so one that doesn't require admission, you know, most of these patients are going to be going for that kind of consultation, is about $500. And so when you're looking at, not only are you not getting the sort of preventative upstream healthcare, you're not getting continuity of care, you're not, you know, managing these complex patients with someone who knows you, but you're also, you know, the public system is spending eight times as much money for that, you know, lower acuity care. So certainly I think people are going to be presenting with much more late stage disease, much more complex disease, things that, you know, potentially are irreversible or, you know, fatal. But also just in terms of the burden for the healthcare system for outcomes that are less sort of tragic and devastating, it's still, you know, pretty disastrous.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, we've spoken about what, you know, what community health centres do. It's not just the acute healthcare, it's the ongoing care, it's counselling, it's chronic disease management, as you said. I don't think people understand the scale of what 12,000 people will be dealing with and the impact on the entire community across, you know, the city of Yarra and Melbourne as well. I wonder what it's been like to help organize and mobilize this, you know, such a range of emotions that are really heightened, of people who are genuinely really scared. And honestly, a lot of this lack of access will result in like deaths from AOD, from lack of support, people delaying help seeking. So yeah, how do you kind of organize and manage all that to come together for this rally?
I mean, I think it's been so inspiring. One thing sort of I didn't sort of quite appreciate going to these meetings is the real living memory of what community healthcare means in the area. I'm not from Melbourne originally, and obviously have been so you know, blown away by the sort of passion of the staff members that I work with. But in, you know, Collingwood in particular, at that meeting, people have a living memory of real ownership over their community health services. It used to be you know, run by the community, with AGMs that were run in tents, not boardrooms, with hundreds of people there, translated into sort of 10 language. People had a real investment in their community healthcare and felt the consequences of that. There were stories of patients there who, you know, openly said that my life was saved, my children's life was saved in, you know, a real meaningful way by these centres. And so harnessing that feeling and that sentiment has been incredible, and meeting the people has been incredible. We're certainly expecting a really big turnout on Saturday, and we wish that there, you know, will be as many people as possible being there. I think is really transformative. This is a campaign that I think is not symbolic. It's like a real winnable campaign, and one that really needs to be won. I don't think these centres closing is an option. And, you know, 12,000 people standing up saying that my life is at risk here is something that really can't be ignored. And so I think the goal on Saturday, and certainly Saturday is not the end of it, the first rally is on Saturday, and we want that to be as big as possible, because every delay is causing sort of more strife and anxiety and uncertainty among the peoples whose lives are on the line. But there will be continued escalations and campaigns until this is won, because it's really not an option.
Yeah, it's a real attack on people. I mean, it's, we've spoken about how the GP closing centres is like, right, so we're closing them right near all the towers that are sent to be demolished. But we will still run them out of the youth prison as well as the Royal Children's Hospital.
Yeah, great.
That makes absolutely no sense. And you stated that there's been some symbolic motions in Parliament. Mm-hmm. Obviously, that's not enough. But what has been passed in Parliament?
Well, I mean, the motion passed in Parliament is, you know, good. And certainly we don't disagree with, you know, people in Parliament sort of recognising community healthcare and recognising the crisis. But it's not enforceable. And no sort of public statements have been made about, you know, this is not going to happen. And certainly that's the red line for the community and for us as the campaign, is that no interruption of services, no closures at all, no reduction of services. We don't want the services to be, you know, closed for a review. We don't want them to be closed for a restructure. We don't want these cuts to be paused. We want a, you know, public acknowledgement that this will not go ahead. There will be no interruption of services. These 12,000 patients will not lose their services.
Yeah, absolutely. Because right now it's, I know the Collingwood Centre is set to close next year, mm-hmm. early next year. Was it in March or April?
Well, I mean, March, and then but already things are winding up. They've closed their books for sort of more newer appointments.
Yeah.
There's lots of difficulties with people accessing pathology services. So I think proposal now is December 16th, although there has been sort of alternate dates proposed around that. Really by the end of this year, early next year, and already there is a massive winding down of services.
And the services are closing in December as well with mm-hmm. the GP services. Mm-hmm. Could you tell us, just to wrap up, what we could expect from the rally on
Saturday
yes. at 2 p.m. outside Labor Sarah Whitty's office. That's mm-hmm. 142 Johnson Street in Fitzroy. I know it's going to be huge. I'm going to get everybody and all our listeners, please come down. It's so important. And there's quite a few rallies on this weekend, but really it's like trying to mobilise this campaign. Mm-hmm. What can people expect?
Well, hopefully a big angry rally. We really want, I think we're sort of fortunate in the position that Labor in both the state and federal government, they could save these clinics tomorrow. And that is the goal. And so certainly we've got healthcare workers, we've got, relative unions involved. So unionists working with the firefighters who are going to have to start answering, overloaded paramedic calls and on flow. We've got unionists from the HACSU, from the Health and Human Services Union, who are going to be talking about what the impact this is going to have on all of their homeless clients, on all their social work, the clients that they deal with. We've got people from the towers who are there to talk about the impact this is going to have on their lives. We've got the mayor of Yarra, Steve Jolly, is coming to speak as well, obviously, who's responding to the total chaos that he's witnessing and hearing among his electorate. So I think this is an issue that sort of really cuts through a lot of the sort of divisions that might otherwise exist, and really just across the board, people are in support of this campaign.
Yeah, amazing. Thank you so much. It's such an important cross-movement mobilising campaign, so please show up this Saturday, 8th of November at 2 p.m. outside Sarah Whitty's office at 142 Johnson Street, Fitzroy. But thank you so much, Shade, for coming on.
Thanks so much for having me.
And you just heard from Shade, a GP at a community health clinic who's also worked in the public health system, who joins us to discuss the Save the Co-Health rally this Saturday, and about how the federal government and statewide health can help save this clinic. It'll affect over 12,000 people, and we can't let this happen.
3CR would like to thank our sponsors, Earth Greetings, cards that connect, care, and celebrate. Support wildlife and habitat with every purchase. Inspired by nature, giving back to the planet. Learn more at earthgreetings.com.au. You're listening to Thursday Breakfast on 3CR 855 AM. It is at 7:47 in the morning, and we're now going to hear from Dr. Ezzedine Shahab, a Palestinian physician in northern Gaza, who's shared his reflections on practicing medicine during Israel's ongoing genocide. Dr. Shahab has collaborated with Readers and Writers Against the Genocide to publish Diary of a Young Doctor, a remarkable collection of diary entries that he's kept to document eyewitness accounts of the genocide. You can order your copy of Diary of a Young Doctor by heading to linktr.ee/readers-writers-against-genocide. And you can also follow Dr. Shahab on Instagram at @EZZIDENSHEHAB. But we'll have those links in our show notes. Now, also wanted to let you know that Readers and Writers Against the Genocide are staging a read-in at the State Library of Victoria today from 5 p.m., and they encourage attendees to bring along their copies of Diary of a Young Doctor to participate. But for now, let's hear from Dr. Ezzedine Shahab himself. A few weeks ago, I was contacted by a member of Readers and Writers Against the Genocide, a volunteer who's been assisting with some publicity and marketing for the group. Readers and Writers Against the Genocide is about to release its first book project, coming out on the 10th of November, Diary of a Young Doctor by Dr. Ezzedine Shahab, a Gazan physician who remains in Gaza during the ongoing genocide. This is a remarkable book made up of a series of Ezzedine's diary entries, and it's a powerful eyewitness account of the genocide from an extraordinary 29-year-old physician and writer.
Ezzedine had only just returned to Gaza, having completed his medical studies overseas when the genocide began. In fact, he got back to Gaza only 5 days before the 7th of October and celebrated with his family without any knowledge of what was to come. In a devastating turn, on the 11th of October, 42 members of his extended family were killed in an Israeli airstrike, beginning his incredible story of survival and service to his people under the genocide. For over 8 months, Dr. Shahab volunteered at the Indonesian hospital in northern Gaza, witnessing firsthand the catastrophic injuries and deaths caused by Israel's genocidal onslaught on the Strip. In December of 2024, Dr. Shahab co-founded the Al-Rahma Medical Clinic, which was intended to provide free medical care in northern Gaza where there were no more functioning hospitals. Unfortunately, it was forced to close in July 2025 after being damaged multiple times by the ongoing Israeli bombardment. Dr. Shahab and his family have been displaced multiple times within Gaza and are still currently weathering the ongoing bombardment and targeting of Palestinian schools, homes, medical facilities, and encampments. Now, the exchange you're about to hear didn't proceed like a regular interview on Thursday Breakfast. Because Dr. Shahab is in Gaza, and due to the impacts of the ongoing siege and communications blackouts, we've had to do this interview asynchronously. I sent through some written questions, and Dr. Shahab responded with short voice messages. So in what follows, I'll describe what I asked Dr. Shahab, and I'll let his answers speak for themselves. The first thing I wanted to know from Dr. Shahab was where he was speaking to us from and what felt most present to him at the time that he was recording his responses.
I am speaking to you now from a small apartment we have rented temporarily after the war destroyed our home. We no longer have a place of our own, and we are staying here until we understand where things are heading. So much remains uncertain about the ceasefire, and we still live with the constant fear that the war may return. Yet I am grateful that my words have begun to reach people, that some will read them and truly understand what we have lived through. In a way, I feel I have created something real and lasting, something that will remain, the book.
I asked Dr. Shahab what compelled him to keep a diary during the genocide and about the role that writing has played in his life over these past 2 years.
I wrote whenever I felt the need to write, whenever I witnessed something or lived through a moment that made me want to scream. Without writing, I would have gone insane. I would have lost my mind with everything I saw, with everything people were forced to endure. And still, what I write is only a drop in the ocean compared to what is truly happening.
I was interested to hear about Dr. Shahab's reflections on being a physician during the genocide, noting that he's been working tirelessly alongside healthcare workers and emergency responders to serve his people. I asked him what his practice has looked like during this time and whether he could share some reflections on the meaning of medicine or even of health during a genocide.
The healthcare situation had always been disparate. What we called hospital no longer resembled hospitals. They were fragile medical outposts, stripped of the most basic tools, the simplest medicines, the smallest hope. They were meant to be sanctuaries, places of safety and neutrality, but they weren't. They were bombed again and again. Many of our colleagues, doctors, nurses were killed inside the very walls where life was supposed to be protected. In those moments, we were fighting more than one war, a war to save others from dying and another to keep ourselves alive.
Of course, I wanted to know about what life had been like since the announcement of the ceasefire. I asked Dr. Shahab to describe some of the reality of the so-called ceasefire for Gazans.
As for the ceasefire, what has taken place so far is merely a halt to the direct bombardment of civilians, along with the limited entry of a humanitarian aid and a small quantity of commercial goods that sold now at several times their original prices. the scale of assistance remains severely inadequate. Personally, my family hasn't received any aid to this day. Israeli warplanes continue to hover constantly over Gaza's skies, and all border crossings remain closed, preventing people from leaving for education, medical treatment, or work. This initial phase of the ceasefire is a positive step, as it has at least stopped the daily killing. But it is only the beginning of a long and difficult path that must lead towards stability, reconstruction, and the restoration of dignified and secure life for the people of Gaza.
The final question that I asked Dr. Shahab was about any key messages he would like to leave our listeners with.
I want to thank everyone who stood with us, everyone who supported us, and everyone who helped carry our voices to the world. But I need people to understand something. The war isn't over. Our daily reality hasn't returned to normal. We are still walking a long route toward a just peace, toward dignity, toward the stability our people have long been denied. This is why I wrote my book, to record the pain, the resilience, and the moments the world never sees, so that one day no one can say they didn't know, they didn't see, they didn't hear. And I want to say this clearly. The people of Gaza are not heroes. They are human beings. They are mothers, fathers, sons, and daughters who have simply reached their limit. They are tired, tired of loss, tired of burying their loved ones, tired of starting over again and again. My message is simple. Don't look away. Keep speaking, keep sharing, keep standing with Gaza. Because our struggle isn't a headline to move past. It is still happening right now, every single day.
And that was the remarkable Dr. Ezzedine Shahab, a Palestinian physician in northern Gaza, who has recently collaborated with Readers and Writers Against the Genocide to publish Diary of a Young Doctor, which is a collection of diary entries that Dr. Shahab kept to document eyewitness accounts of the genocide. You can order your copy of Diary of a Young Doctor by heading to linktr.ee/readers-writers-against-genocide. And you can also follow Dr. Shahab on Instagram at Ezzedine Shahab. Readers and Writers Against the Genocide are staging a read-in at the State Library of Victoria today from 5 p.m. and encourage attendees to bring along copies of Diary of a Young Doctor, if they've been able to get one, to participate. And there will be links in our show notes for where you can purchase Diary of a Young Doctor, which has hit bookshelves prior to its anticipated release date on the 10th of November. So you can grab a copy right now. It is 7:57 in the morning and you're listening to Thursday Breakfast. Inez, take us into our next segment.
Yes, if you're just joining us, we have spoken about a treaty with the discussion with Uncle Robbie Thorpe and Senator Lydia Thorpe, the Save the Co-Health Rally. That is this Saturday at 2 p.m. outside of Sarah Whitty's office. A beautiful interview from Priya and Dr. Ezzedine Shahab, a Palestinian physician in northern Gaza, as well as some very important voice messages ahead of justice for Imar Blay's family. And now we will go to my interview with Touch Sensitive, a.k.a. Michael D. Francesco, who is one of Australia's most beloved electronic artists, bassists and producers, known for his Italo disco flair, piano house grooves and undeniable presence. You know, he's long been a staple in the Melbourne Australian music scene and has released his second album, called In Paradise. This comes after 8 years of his debut album, Visions, in 2017, ahead of the next concert that he'll have at the Nightcat in Fitzroy on Saturday the 8th at 8 p.m. So yeah, take a listen to this and we'll play a song from his album afterwards. Thanks so much, Michael, for coming to speak to us today. How are you?
I'm good, thank you. Thanks for having me.
Yeah, congratulations on your long-awaited second studio album, In Paradise. I was wondering what your vision for the album was when you were starting out and how maybe this changed throughout the process from like jamming, producing, mixing, figuring out what to keep.
I just kind of got tired of sitting on the computer by myself. And so many of my friends are like amazing players and like shredders. So And, you know, I spent ages agonizing over, because when computer music can, I mean, the way that I've been doing it is, you know, I've just been agonizing over like little details and transitions and things. And like, it, you can sometimes take shortcuts and cheat and use tricks to go between sections or whatever and add excitement and dynamics, because all that stuff is kind of to a certain degree lacking. But when you put people playing instruments, that kind of those little intricacies just happen naturally. And that's kind of what I wanted to do, just do something different and get out of my comfort zone and work with my friends and have a good time while I was doing it. And yeah, like most of the sessions I'd leave with a sore stomach from laughing so much. Like it was, yeah.
Oh, that's so sweet.
It was really cool. Actually, the reason I was late was because I was talking to Ross Ferrara, who played drums on pretty much everything except for a couple. Yeah.
Well, it's a good segue, because my next question was, did you seek to push yourself out of your comfort zone with this album?
Oh, yeah, 100%. 100%. And also, I did 2 weeks, 1 week at 301 and then 1 week at Senti Studios. And then I went away with all of the jams and cut them up and picked out the best bits. But then it kind of sat on my computer for a year and didn't really know what to do with it. And then my manager mentioned, oh, hey, why don't we play some of this to Tony Buchan and see what he thinks? And then, yeah, we did. And he immediately was like, oh, I reckon this one would make a cool album. Like, let's work on it. So we went in. And which is also another big thing for me being out of my comfort zone, because up until now I've just like been self-produced. So this was working with another producer. Not that I haven't worked with other producers in the past, but like kind of not being able to, you know, putting all everything that I had into his system and, you know, and leaving the studio and going home and not being able to open it and tinker and like, you know, committing to the changes and committing to the process. That was another, that was a really big part of it, was doing that and kind of, yeah, that was definitely out of my comfort zone.
Yeah, it's beautiful. Yeah, I can definitely like feel the collaboration and all the songs that were jabbing to it all week. But I also know that you've been influenced by Italo disco and like 90s, early 2000s house and jazz. But I was curious, besides musical influences, was there anything else you were influenced by, like colors or smells or memories?
Oh, yeah, I love, I collect like the Art Director Guide to Photography books from the late 70s, even through the 90s. So a lot of that like advertising where there were massive budgets and the photographs are kind of, you can't tell if they're real or if they're not, because they're otherworldly.
Yep.
Yeah, so definitely visually that's a big part of it as well.
Yeah, in what way do you think it's otherworldly?
Yeah, it just doesn't look natural. It doesn't look like, yeah, it's not natural. And also there's things that are staged that do have humans in them are just so immaculate. You know, there's no faults. It's just beautiful and warm. Yeah.
Yeah. I think even listening to you speak about it, it's also kind of how I felt listening to your debut album Visions, which is on repeat. I remember playing it at parties during a set, then when I was studying, and then on a long drive when I was heartbroken, and then also falling in love. So I've always been curious about how artists envision the second life of their work when it comes out. How do you envision people listening to the album in its second life?
Oh, that's a really good question. I guess maybe in a cafe, in the car, like in life, I guess, you know. Okay, for example, I was in the bathroom at Sydney Airport and I heard Mystery of Cats.
Wow.
While I was in the bathroom, because the bathroom has bathroom music. So I thought, and you know, I never imagined that to be what people would be going to the bathroom to. So yeah, just life.
Yeah, it's really beautiful. I think it'll live on to be an absolute dance floor classic, but also a really beautiful way that you can soundtrack like memories with friends. And I just really feel that when I'm listening to the album. Okay. And I also really admire how throughout your career you've placed so much importance on collaboration, particularly with this album. How do you keep a track cohesive and organic, particularly when multiple artists are like jumping in and out of it?
I guess because the common thread throughout it all is me. So I still, as much as I sometimes dislike myself in what I do and get bored and like get stuck in ruts, it's sometimes the collaboration with other people that kind of pulls you out of that. But also at the same time, no matter what I do, it's just always going to be me.
Yeah.
Like, so I feel like that's the common thread. I mean, yeah, and there have been some things actually. There's one particular clap that I use like on everything. It made its final appearance on this record, and yeah, it's since gone in the bin. So it's that's another thing, is like, you know, you have your default things that, I mean, your things that you kind of just default to naturally. So in this instance, I feel like I've pretty much removed a fair amount of that.
Yeah, was it hard kind of like editing and ordering the track list and going through that story?
Well, no, with that I definitely had help from Chad, who's like one of my managers, who's the A&R, who has awesome taste and is tells the truth. But between myself, Chad and Tony, that was how we came up with the playlisting. Yeah,
beautiful. And I know, speaking of collaboration, congratulations on becoming a father. And what do you think?
That's definitely a collaborative effort. Yeah.
I guess, what do you think being an artist and a parent and a partner kind of all have in common? Because I can like see the transferable skills, if you will. But how do you feel your work has kind of been influenced by this chapter of your life?
I'd say with my first daughter, it took me a long time to kind of, just get used to not being able to just wake up in the morning and do whatever I wanted. And now the second time around, that's kind of even more obvious. So now I feel, I mean, I didn't really for a few years feel focused, but now I definitely feel focused, because if I do have 2 or 3 hours spare, I'm definitely not wasting them. So I have definitely wasted a lot of time tinkering and waiting for things to fall out of the sky into my lap as far as creative ideas and stuff go. Because, you know, you could spend a whole day on a computer and kind of just, faff around until hopefully something good comes, and it may or may not. But like, if you're now that I have limited time, it's kind of maybe a little bit more of a plan with a bit of magic.
Yeah.
Jazz on top, like improvisation stuff on top, yeah.
Yeah, beautiful. From a change from like being able to spend more hours on a track and like mixing and mastering it, but now when it's like more focused, how do you get yourself like into that zone, or is it a different process now?
No, it's definitely hard.
Yep. Yeah.
Definitely hard. But also I feel, I don't know. It's hard, but you just have to get over the hump. You know, so some of the times when we were jamming on the record, there were a couple of things, like for example, Maze in My Mind, like we spent maybe 2 minutes on that. And I remember at the time, nobody seemed really like excited about it. And we played it for like a minute. And then, I just said, I feel like we've got enough of this one. Like that's enough. And then luckily there was enough in there for me to cut and make up into something. But yeah, you just have to get past that initial like hump of trying to do something, and then it will happen, because it doesn't always happen straight away. I mean, it can to a certain extent, but maybe not to the level that you're hoping. And then you just have to go until you get there.
Yeah, amazing. And do you think even living away like in the US and in Sydney, or like a little bit in Melbourne as well, have these cities like influenced your sound or the inspiration for the album?
Definitely influenced by the Qantas hold music that they play on the plane, like when you're boarding and stuff. I mean, I loved America. I loved living there, but I am very grateful to be back. And Australia is just the most amazing place. It truly is. America was cool because everything that I love musically is from there pretty much. With the exception of, you know, not everything, but a good portion of it. So being there and just, you know, maybe not necessarily participating or like going to all the events, but just knowing, oh, hey, Herbie Hancock's playing at the Hollywood Bowl tonight with a bunch of other like crazy dudes.
Amazing.
I could go. I probably should go, but it's too hard. But then when you're in Australia, you wish that those things were happening but they're not. But then when I was there, they were happening, and I was came, you know, it was just having the, just knowing that it was happening and knowing that it was just around the corner was kind of enough to inspire me, I guess.
Yeah, beautiful. How has it been kind of coming back and performing since lockdowns have kind of opened up and the pandemic? Like, what is your take on, I guess, the performance culture right now?
When I've done gigs in and out, it's kind of hard to tell, but I will be able to get like a proper read on all that stuff in the coming weeks with the shows that are coming up. Then I'll have a fair idea of what the vibe is. But yeah, because I feel like the shows that I have done or come back to do were it was like maybe pre-album and not.
No, that's okay. I know that you've released some really beautiful footage of the band and you're playing at the Nightcat this Saturday on the 8th of November. Why was the live band important to you?
Okay, so because I am so sick of the computer.
Yeah.
And this is an opportunity to like play with my friends and not be tied down to a click track or a backing track and just like have fun and stretch things out. And yeah, I actually, the rehearsals have been awesome. We've got the first show this week in Sydney. So yeah, I'm super pumped.
Yeah. Have you felt like an energy shift in the room from like any previous rehearsals?
Oh, it's so good. It's so much fun. Yeah.
Yeah.
It's going to be hard to come back, to go back to just being me, or maybe I'll do a cut down version, but yeah, from going from that, cause it is very expensive to fly, move people around and pay them. So yeah, I'm not sure how sustainable it will be, but yeah, if when I can afford to do it, I will that is definitely the route I will be taking, because it's way more fun. It's like I feel like it's so much better. And if you're having fun, then I feel like that translates, and people don't want to see someone on the stage solving problems because some piece of gear isn't working, you know, like there's no, you know. And the thing is with the band, and you know, this is by no means anything new. This is like how music is made, how it should be made. But I feel like for me personally, I just fell into this trap of like the music was so production heavy that every time I would play live, I'd be like, oh, it's missing this and it's missing that and it's missing that and it needs this and it needs that. So for these shows, like some of the, like for example, Pizza Guy, we're doing it like the vocalists are singing like the sample bits and stuff.
Wow.
So they kind of reimagine it. And it's just so much more fun, I feel like.
Yeah, it does sound like a very fun gig and not one that you want to miss. Is there something that you hope that the crowd feels when they're in the room at the Nightcat?
Yeah, I just hope that the fun that we're having on stage and the joy that's on stage is transcends into the audience. That's the most important thing, that people like feel good when they leave. Yeah.
Yeah, amazing. And lastly, how can we follow your work and your new album and buy tickets to the show?
The tickets are available. Oh yeah,
on the Nightcat website.
Yes, yes.
Yeah. We'll have it linked in our show notes.
Yeah. Once the dust, I literally just moved back 3 weeks ago. So once the dust settles, yeah, then I'll start making another one.
Yeah, amazing. Is there anything else you'd like to leave our listeners with?
No, I feel like we covered everything. Yeah. Okay. But yeah, thank you so much for having me.
No, thank you so much. Well, we'll see you next time. Bye.
Awesome. Thank you. Bye.
And that was my interview with Touch Sensitive, one of Australia's most beloved electronic artists, bassists, producers, and a longtime, you know, staple of the Australian music scene, ahead of his second album, 8 years after his debut album, Visions. This is In Paradise, the title track from this album, ahead of his show at the Nightcat this Saturday. And that was In Paradise, the title track from the long-awaited second studio album from Touch Sensitive, a vibrant, groovy dance number that is not only beautifully produced, but a dynamic feel-good story between Michael and his live band. Catch him at the Night Cat this Saturday at 8 p.m. On the 8th of November.
Amazing. And we will have information about how to get tickets in our show notes. You're on Thursday Breakfast on 3CR 855 AM, and we are now joined for our final interview of today by Bakri Mahmoud, who is a photographer, filmmaker, and organizer. And Bakri is going to speak with us about ongoing mutual aid efforts for Sudan and also discuss the importance of disrupting narratives of civil war being used to brand the catastrophic conflict between the RSF and the SAF, the responsibilities and failures of so-called Australia in taking action on this crisis, and the importance of continued efforts to support Sudanese liberation. Good morning, Bakri.
Good morning. Thank you for having me.
Yeah, of course. Now, I just wanted to jump into things by asking you about some of those narratives that have been circulating about Sudan's civil war and why these need to be challenged in order to understand the regional power dynamics and interests that are at play.
Yeah, I think one of the main critiques of using the term civil war is that for the most part, it's not really a civil war because it's not a civil conflict between any two tribes or community of people in that regard. It's a conflict of power struggle between generals and, I guess, people with different foreign interests in terms of the land's resources. So it's described more as a counter-revolutionary conflict where the two kind of like major warring powers are both just trying to, claim, I guess, power for themselves so they can exploit the land's resources with no real interest for the people's safety, especially not from the RSF. I guess framing it as a civil war kind of implicates that the country itself is broken or people are fighting each other when really it's one kind of like militia group, who have a lot of power from, you know, backers such as the UAE and to some degree Russia and Chad and Libya, who are, I guess, mainly interested in gold mines that are abundant in that, particularly in the western part of Sudan and the Darfur region, and have developed a solid base there. But they're in no way have any interest of building a nation like they claim to be trying to building a nation now. And, you know, are kind of trying to push this narrative of, like, separation. But really it's just so they can, you know, bolster their, I guess, hold on the resources in that area so they can continue, which they haven't stopped really trade of Sudan's resources, particularly gold. One of the main leaders of the RSF, Hameti, himself is a company that he mines gold from and has an airport out of there to fly aid straight from the UAE and to fly gold straight out of Sudan to the UAE. So this is why this war has been able to, like, be sustained.
Yeah.
So long, yeah.
Yeah, I mean, what you've described sounds like a struggle for power between elite interests that don't really reflect the concerns, needs, and aspirations of the Sudanese people. And yet, you know, they've had to bear the immense suffering of being subjected to this conflict and to be subjected to a genocide as part of this conflict. Now, I wanted to ask you about so-called Australia's responses to the ongoing catastrophe and calls from the Sudanese diaspora for Australia to act.
Look, that's always going to be an uphill battle. We live in a state that takes a lot to do anything. The only act really I can see Australia doing is, you know, putting sanctions on the United Arab Emirates, which I don't see them doing anytime soon again, because Australia has their, you know, trade agreements with that country, and we want to keep the value of gold that we bring into here at a certain level. You know, and there are resources that come out of Sudan beyond gold, such as anything that comes from the acacia tree, that really keep the West functioning, and in the sense of their materials that go into Coca-Cola, into paint, into pharmaceuticals. And so if Australia were to, you know, put sanctions or cut ties with these countries, the price of these products would be very expensive for us. But that is the price of Sudanese suffering, really. Mm. And at the end of the day, our institutions can just ignore that all too easily and frame it as this internal conflict that this country is having that has nothing to do with us. That's why, again, like that narrative of civil war that is not connected to our global trade interests is part of the problem. So if Australia starts to recognise that, then the whole kind of capitalist project starts to fall down on itself. So I think that's what we're pushing for, to put sanctions on UAE and, you know, put pressure in that way. But, yeah, it's, I don't know, like, yeah, what no, outcome we're going to expect with that. Yeah,
it is. Yeah. It is really, really challenging. But there are some important calls to boycott the UAE as consumers as well, including, you know, like Emirates Airlines. I did want to ask you about as well updates on the situation in El Fasher after the October 26th massacre. And I know that there's an action that is coming up this weekend to remember the martyrs of that massacre.
Yep, so that's happening this Sunday at 12 p.m. at the State Library. It's been organized by Salt of Sudan and a few other organizations. And yeah, this is just to, I guess, make those calls for, you know, our government to try and put pressure on UAE and to remind people to boycott Emirati products. And I guess just to mourn the dead and to grieve collectively, because it was a horrible thing to witness, and we'd been witnessing famine and violence and rape for years now, but this latest situation with El Fasher really felt like a very personal loss. Like it was like losing a family member, or like, you know, someone, you know, being witnessed. But it's hard as black people, as Muslim people, seeing our people being killed. It's traumatizing. So I think that's why a lot of people are coming together, just to have a big sigh and just hold each other for a bit, and just, you know, show that we're protesting, we're resisting, we're out here. And I think, you know, as much as we've been doing great work with mutual aid, like some of this stuff is also incredibly important, and it just gives us a voice and says that we're not going down quietly. Yeah,
I think you know, you can't underestimate the importance of collectively and publicly grieving as a way to demonstrate that people are still paying attention to Sudan. And that, you know, the lives of the people of Sudan matter, and that people care, they see that connection, and they are in the fight no matter where they are in the diaspora. Now, I did want to close out just asking you about that mutual aid organizing that you've been doing and the extent to which organizers like yourself have been able to maintain contact and supply lines to people on the ground.
It's tricky, but Sudanese people have a way of always knowing someone, because we're all such interconnected communities, and we all have big families, and big families have cousins, and they have friends that, you know, despite there being these two elite powers fighting for each other, the groundwork of community members is always there. It's always an underground. You know, we've had a civilian revolution that now we're paying an immense cost for, but it doesn't mean, and a lot of people have had to leave and flee, and a lot of people are stuck, a lot of people are still, you know, in refugee settlements in Sudan or in Egypt, but you know, phone lines somehow still work. And there are these kind of like unofficial networks for ways to send aid. It's difficult right now. I cannot confirm that we're actually getting aid directly into El Fasher itself. Mm. However, I do know that with the mutual aid work that I'm doing, it's mainly my mum and her connections that are able to get aid to where they can get it. But she's confirmed to me that they've been focusing a lot of that aid into the like people coming out of Darfur, whether they have like fled to the nearest city outside of Darfur, not quite in Khartoum, or they made it all the way to Khartoum. And it's kind of visible, those numbers.
Mm-hmm.
So it's easier for us to reach them in that regard.
And
so
yeah.
No,
I was just going to say it's an immense amount of effort to go to for people to do this through informal networks without, you know, a massive coordinated effort. And it speaks both to the tenacity and effort of yourself and other organizers doing this work, but also to the catastrophic failure of the international community to put an end to this genocidal conflict and to actually reinstate those supply lines and to support Sudanese calls for liberation.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
Yeah, absolutely. And it's been well documented and well reported that, you know, this conflict is a direct result of UAE's political and capitalist interests. But again, no major body is willing to do anything that's going to disrupt their kind of agreement to stop that. And you know, this stuff goes way back to this, like, Arabization and, like, Arab supremacy and those issues, and we can't really talk about this stuff, talking about that.
Yeah.
And capitalism in general. And so it's a big thing because, you know, this seems like an isolated issue, but it is a reflection of white supremacy and capitalism and Arab supremacy and broader the little things that affect every single one of us. We just have to kind of have that awareness. So every single one of us can show up this Sunday if we want to.
Yeah.
Or donate to mutual aid.
Absolutely. Yep. And we'll have information about those donation details and about the rally in our show notes. And thank you again. I really hope that we can continue to get into this issue. Bakri, I really appreciate your time and all of your efforts.
No worries at all. Thank you so much, Priya.
And that was Bakri Mahmoud, who is telling us about ongoing mutual aid efforts for Sudan. That's all we've got time for today on Thursday Breakfast. But a quick rundown, we heard Uncle Robbie Thorpe and Lydia Thorpe speaking about treaty. We heard from Shade, a GP trainee at a community health clinic, about the rally for co-health. We heard from Dr. Ezzedine Shahab, a Palestinian physician in northern Gaza. We heard a wonderful interview with Touch Sensitive, and there is a show upcoming this Saturday, the 8th of November. And finally, we heard from Bakri about the situation in Sudan.
3CR Breakfast would like to thank the New International Bookshop, Melbourne's radical bookstore and venue, for their financial support of this program. You can find NIBS opposite reception in the Lygon Street wing of Trades Hall, Carlton.